Dr. Sheila Murphy. Dr. Murphy and her colleagues at the University of Southern California Hollywood Health and Society at the Norman Lear Center, the BBC World Service Trust, examine how health-related information is conveyed in popular television, both in the U.S. and internationally, and the factors, such as identification with character, emotion, or transportation, that make a particular health-related storyline more or less effective in changing viewers' knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs. The title of her talk today is Longitudinal Effects of Narrative versus Non-Narrative Health Messages on Promoting Women's Cervical Cancer-Related Knowledge, Attitudes, and Behavior.
Well, thank you for coming and hanging in there. I just wanted to recognize my co-investigators who are in the audience today. So we have my co-PI, Lourdes Baez-Conde-Garbinati, and my time is now up because I said your name. No, okay. And none of us have any conflict of interest, but we would very much like to. So if you have money, please see us afterwards. Also, Lauren Frank, who is also on this panel, Joy Chatterjee, Megan Moran, Nan Zhao, and our project manager who keeps us all on track, Paula Amazola, are also, I also want to recognize. Okay. So, and the cast of thousands, including the U.S. School of Cinema, who helped us actually make the films that I'm going to be talking about today. So, humans have used narratives or stories to convey important information for thousands of years. But when we in Western medicine try to convey life-threatening and life-saving, potentially, information, we ignore the use of narratives. Why? Well, when you ask that question to government officials like at NCI, which I have, why don't you use narratives, they become very cautious and they say, well, we've never seen hard evidence. We've never had a case study, clinical trial where you presented exactly the same information in both a narrative and a non-narrative format on the actual intended audience and saw which one worked better. And they also pointed out that like a clinical trial, you would not replace the existing standard of care, the existing treatment, the existing pill, unless the new pill works better. It doesn't have to work as well as, has to work actually better than the existing pill, particularly if the existing pill is cheaper, right, and they're comfortable with it. So my question is, the study actually is exactly that. It's a clinical trial, in essence, of comparing narrative versus non-narrative as a format for conveying medical information. Even though we're using cervical cancer information, it really could refer to any sort of health information. And so what we did is, our first research question is, do narratives convey health-related information better than non-narratives? And if so, what are the theoretical mechanisms that make that the case, you know, in terms of changes in knowledge, attitudes, and behavior? Okay? So what we did is a TR01, which is a transformative grant from the National Cancer Institute, thank you, a high-risk, high-reward grant. We produced two 11-minute films, and they each had the same key facts about cervical cancer, the cause, how you detect it via Pap test, and how you prevent it via the HPV vaccine. The non-narrative, which we'll refer to as It's Time, uses a more traditional approach, showing doctors, patients, facts, figures. The narrative, we refer to as the tamale lesson, revolves around a family's preparation for their youngest daughter's 15th birthday or quinceañera. So if you were at Lourdes' presentation earlier today, you saw a clip. I'm going to show just a clip from tamale lesson because of time. This is just some images from the non-narrative version of It's Time. You see, you have the doctor sitting there talking about why it's important to have a test. You actually have a woman getting a Pap test. So for all the women here, you know, slide further down. Instructions are in there. Here she is showing you what the Pap brush actually looks like. And then go to a graphic that actually is animated and shows you what they're actually doing with that brush. And that's sort of the non-narrative. The narrative, I am going to show you a clip. Let's try this. Oh, no, I'm not. Hang on. Okay, let's try this again. Do we? I don't know why this is. One second, for a second. So let me set this up for you while Joy's coming up here. This is a family. They're getting ready. They're making tamales, which is why it's called Tamale Lesson.
Okay, when you go to the doctor, sit on the table, and they spread your legs like this. Okay, so let's pretend this is your vagina.
It's not that color.
Beta, just pretend.
Okay, I'm a tamale.
So the doctor has like this device, this metal device. They just spread the walls of your vagina.
I don't think it works like that.
You never had this question before?
It's not as bad as it looks. They take this mascara type wand and then they just wand them on the inside of my butt.
They take a little sample of yourself.
What if you still have bleeding down there? I mean, are you still having that problem?
And that's all?
Okay, so that's just a clip to tantalize you, and, or not, put you off chicken for lunch, I suppose. And what we did is we did a random digit-dial sample of women in the Los Angeles County area. They had to be between the ages of 25 and 45 to be included in the sample, and we did a pre-test baseline survey of their cervical cancer-related knowledge, attitudes, and behavior. Then we randomly assigned them to receive either a tamale lesson or it's time, although for their purposes, for experimental purposes, we labeled them both it's time, so they wouldn't be influenced by the title. And then they were supposed to watch it at home on DVD, and within 2 weeks we re-interviewed them again. These are just the numbers here, are just for the narrative condition, and there's an equal number in the non-narrative condition, but just to show you the full design. We did not have enough Korean Americans in our sample to make enough of a conclusion. So we're going to just today talk about the European American, the African American, and the Mexican American women in our sample, which end up being 300 of each if you look at both conditions. So there's 900 women in the data I'm going to be talking about for the first half of the study. And then at time three, we wanted to give them enough time to actually go out and follow up, because the behavior of interest was actually whether these women themselves got a Pap test. So, all right. So, our first hypothesis was that the women in the narrative condition who got the tamale lesson, which you just saw a clip of, would actually have a more of an increased knowledge, more positive attitude, and would more likely to either get a Pap or to make an appointment to get a Pap than the women who received the same information, remember, the same facts, in a non-narrative format. So here is the knowledge. The stripes are refer to the knowledge, the non-narrative, and the solid bars here refer to the narrative. So you're comparing, for example, here the Mexican-American women who received the narrative versus the non-narrative European-American women who received the narrative, non-narrative, and so on. So what you see is that both films worked. That's good. We didn't stack the deck to make the non-narrative a terrible film where no one learned anything. In fact, we were a little concerned that we made it work too well when we saw it, because it actually is quite good. And we have copies of both films if anyone wants to talk to me later. But in general, you see that both films worked pretty well, but particularly for the minority groups of the Mexican-American women and the African-American women, the narrative worked better, with an average gain of 2 out of, one item didn't really work, so out of the 10 facts, 9 of the items worked well in both films, and most women gained 2 in the narrative condition, and significant 1.5 or so within the non-narrative condition. From their own, this is individual level change, so this is their own score at pretest. So, here's their attitudes towards the Pap test. Again, change from their pre-test attitudes to after they saw whichever film they were assigned to. And as you see here, they actually were more significantly more positive about Pap testing after seeing the narrative, particularly for the Mexican-American women. And strangely, this is interesting to us because the African-American women almost always mirrored the results of the Mexican-American women. We weren't necessarily expecting that, but that's true. And what about actual behavior? Here what we see, this is what we like this slide very much in our group because what it shows is if you focus just on the gray part of each bar, this is what women came into our study with. And what you'll notice here is this curve here. And what that is showing, it's showing that at time one, at baseline, there was an ethnic disparity in our group of women. And interestingly, this sort of ethnic disparity almost perfectly lines up with the actual ethnic disparity in screening in Los Angeles County, maybe because we had a large enough sample of 900 women. So in other words, coming into our study, European American women were much more likely to have been compliant recently. They had a Pap test within the last 6 months, which is what that gray bar means. These are women who wouldn't be due for another Pap test within the time frame of our study. All right, so they're already compliant. But what the light blue section is, these are the women who actually went and had a Pap test during the next 6 months, the follow-up period. And the dark blue section on top is, as Lauren pointed out before, in LA County you can wait a long time to get in to see the doctor, particularly if you don't have great insurance. And so the dark blue is people who haven't yet had the Pap test but actually made an appointment. And so what excites us here about this slide is that by the time you get to the, if you add all the heights of these three sections together, the Mexican-American women went from being the least compliant, least likely to be in compliance with having a Pap test recently, to being the most compliant group, particularly if they had seen the narratives. Again, both films worked, but the narratives worked better, and the narratives worked better particularly for the Mexican-American and the African-American group. Okay, so our second, and now I'm going to turn from talking about the comparison between narrative and non-narrative, since we've shown that narratives do work better, at least for the minority populations. I'm going to talk about why that might be. What are the underlying theoretical mechanisms that might account for that? So we didn't think that it was going to work, the films were going to work equally well for everyone. We predicted that women who saw the narrative, among women who saw the narrative, the Mexican-Americans in our sample would respond the most. Why? Because we deliberately made both films not exclusively but heavily Latina characters, right? That was a deliberate attempt to sort of manipulate something that we call identification, that you might see yourself more in those particular characters. We also thought the Mexican-Americans might be more transported into the narrative, and I'll describe what that is in a second, and have a stronger emotional response. So, let's look at those. So, transportation. Why do narratives work? Why might they work better than sort of a straight recitation of the facts the way we're used to? Well, one odd idea is that narratives work better because you become transported into the narrative, hence the term transportation as from Green and Brock. The idea is while you're watching a story or narrative, you sort of let down your guard and you sort of absorb the facts without saying, well, that's stupid, I don't believe that. You just sort of let it go. You're sort of couch potatoing into the story. And to the extent that you sort of are in that sort of transported, absorbing state, you're more likely to be compelled by whatever you're being told in that state. And here's some items from Green and Brock's scale, which measure that concept. Something like, I could picture myself in the scenes in the film. These were all measured from 1 to 10. I was mentally involved in the film while I was watching it. The events in the film are relevant to my everyday life, etc. Transportation scale, however, sometimes there's, we're going to be talking about, there's 10 items. One of them, or three of them, actually tend to break out into their own separate subscale. But I'm going to talk about that in a second. Let me just show you what the transportation, those
items on transportation show. Here you can see out of a 10-point scale, there's fair high levels of transportation, but who's most transported? Well, the Mexican-Americans and the African-Americans are equally transported
by the report being equally transported by those items.
And the European-Americans, not bad, but not certainly significantly less transported by our narrative.
Okay?
I talked about the fact that there's a subscale that often breaks away from the other transportation items. There are things like being distracted, and it has to measure immersion, it's called. And they measure things like, I found my mind wandering while watching the film. While I was watching the film, activity going on in the room was on my mind. I found myself thinking of different ways the film could have
ended differently. And what that means is you're sort of distracted. So when I talk about the immersion subscale, it's a sort of distraction element. Okay? So
what this slide suggests is that with a fairly high level of immersion, regardless of ethnicity, right, that everyone is reporting being fairly engrossed,
which is good for us, or immersed.
And finally, we know that not all models are the same. As I said before, we deliberately made both films have a heavily Latina cast because we wanted to sort of manipulate the degree to which we thought people would identify with them, even though they're sort of universal characters. And so we measured the extent to which people, four types of identification from the literature and communication. So wishful identification, how much would you like to be like? Lupita is the girl who has HPV. Connie, her virginal sister, and Petra is the mother's friend who's never had a pap test. So we measured how much they would like to be like those characters, how similar they thought they were, how much they liked those characters, and how much they felt like they knew each of those characters.
Okay?
And here you see the results of those, how their identification with those three characters. Factor analyses shows that, in fact, those four aspects of identification clustered together. So we made a mean value of identification on a scale from 1 to 10 instead of reporting each separately. And as you can see, you see that same pattern of results with the Mexican-Americans being and the African-Americans being most likely to identify with all the characters. They identified more with Lupita and Connie than they did with Petra, but that said, you see the least likely to identify group is clearly the European Americans in our sample.
Okay, and finally we measured emotion. We had measured Ekman's six basic emotions, and it basically boiled down to dividing into positive and negative emotions. So what I'm going to present today is just to what extent did they report feeling happy versus feeling angry, sad, afraid, or disgusted. Okay? So here is the sort of outcome by emotion, and what you see here is, in general, people were more positive about feeling happy after seeing the film versus feeling negative about after seeing the film. However, I'm going to come back to that because it turns out that feeling happy might not actually be a good thing in terms of predicting actual PAP behavior. Okay? So, what happens when you take just the change from pre-test to post-test and follow-up and try to predict that change in knowledge, attitudes, and behavior? Which of these three theoretical constructs will best predict change in knowledge, attitude, and behavior, both at the post-test and at follow-up, because you're holding each person's initial behavior and attitudes and knowledge constant. You're also taking out race and ethnicity. So let's look just from transportation on down. And what you'll see here is that the six items I first showed you from the transportation scale showed that how transported you reported being watching the film predicted your knowledge at 2 weeks out, and it also predicted your behavioral intent to be, that 12 over there, your behavioral intent to be, your behavioral intent to have a PAP test 2 weeks out. The immersion subscale, however, though, that sort of distraction subscale, was the best predictor of all, out of all of our predictors, because that actually predicts both your knowledge, your change in knowledge 2 weeks out, your increase in knowledge 6 months out. It also predicts your having more positive attitudes 6 months out about PAP tests, and your actual intention to have a PAP test 6 months out. So actually that, the immersion subscale actually predicts all three of our key dependent outcomes. And then, interestingly, identification, it matters who you identify with. If you identify with Lupita, you are more likely to have a positive attitude both to about PAP tests and having one yourself, both at 2 weeks at post and at 6 months follow-up. Identifying with Connie, who's the virginal sister, didn't do you harm or good, but identifying with Petra, who is the mother's friend with the curlers, she actually has a negative influence. People who said they identified with Petra not only had the lowest level of knowledge to begin with, they actually decreased in knowledge over time, and at both at post-test and at follow-up attitude, they had a very negative, 6 months later, they still had a very negative attitude towards PAP tests and getting a PAP test themselves. So, finally, I said that there was something interesting saying that the film made you feel happy, because that actually turned out to be not such a great thing either. Because what happened is, well, you sort of relaxed a little, maybe a little bit too much, so that was nice. And you end up with having an actual significant decrease in knowledge both two weeks later. You have a less positive attitude about PAP tests 2 weeks later. And finally, you have significantly lower intentions to follow up with the PAP 6 months later. So, let me just wrap up. What did we learn? Well, we learned that narratives can be a valuable tool in health communication if the audience members become immersed or transported into the narrative. And this may require some sort of professional help. We had help with professional screenwriters, professional filmmakers. I'm always a little nervous presenting these results because people say, oh, I could write a story. Well, yes, I could dance Swan Lake, too. I didn't even write this story, you know what I mean? So, in the immortal words of Mark Twain, I like a story well told, and that is the reason I'm sometimes forced to tell them myself. In other words, I just want us as a collective community, and that's myself included, to remember we are not Mark Twain. There are people who do this for a living. We might want to look to them for help. Because I have this fear that every public health person will say, oh, I can write a story. Sure, I could do that. You have to test, and part of this has to be a warning about just making sure that people are transported by your narrative. And narratives featuring positive role models that underserved populations can identify with may be particularly helpful in reducing health disparities. That's true. We saw that, and even we actually think this might be even more true as you go down in terms of literacy. We have a version of this we're running in Spanish with a lower literacy, lower acculturation Spanish population right now. But what I want to say is you have to pretest whether a character has the intended effect. For example, Petra, the mother's best friend with the curlers, she actually was supposed to be what we call a transitional character. She was supposed to let women who had never had a PAP test identify with her, because at the end of the film, she ends up getting a PAP test.
And that's referred to as a transitional character, somebody who starts out as a negative role model and ends up being a positive role model. However, when we collected the final data, it turned out we may have made that transition too late because she basically stayed a negative role model. And she had overall negative effects, such that if you identified with her, you ended up having these negative impacts and not moving in the way you wanted to. And so, again, caution is to pretest whether narrative actually resonates with all segments of your population. Now, it didn't, in fact, have a negative effect on any segment of our audience, but I do want to read just a quote from a focus group member. We focus group these constantly at every stage of development production, and here is a quote from one of the European American focus groups referring to tamale lesson. Anyone can relate to a warm family. That was well done, but quote unquote, it's Hispanic. You're not going to be showing it to a bunch of white women in Beverly Hills. So did it have a negative impact? No, but clearly, if they don't see themselves in that story, it's not going to have as big of an effect as you might have hoped, because they won't identify with the characters. So again, just sort of a word of caution that, you know, pre-test, post-test, keep testing, making sure with the different elements of your target audience that you're not actually having unintended consequences.
Okay? All right, thank you.